From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
For most of us, the pandemic has faded into an unpleasant memory, a time of extraordinary dislocation that has left our lives changed in many ways. For the policymakers, however, the lessons of that time are still being examined, because there's a general expectation that one day we'll face another such crisis. The federal government has an inquiry on foot about how things were handled. Meanwhile, two academic economists, Stephen Hamilton and Richard Holden, have a book out that provides a report card on how Australia performed. Hamilton is based in Washington, visiting the Australian National University frequently. Holden is Professor of Economics at UNSW's Business School and President of the Academy of Social Sciences. Their book, titled Australia's Pandemic Exceptionalism, examines both what we did exceptionally well and what we did exceptionally badly. Today we're joined by Richard Holden to look back on the pandemic, as well as to look forward on the Australian economy. Richard Holden, in your book, you write that in Australia the pandemic was a tale of two policy responses. You invoke the words of Charles Dickens, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." You say we did well with the economic response, but it was a mixed picture on the health side. Could you just sketch this out for us?
Of course, and great to talk to you, Michelle. On the economic front, you know, we were faced with a very, very scary time. The possibility of what was being predicted were things like 15% unemployment, significant double-digit drops in GDP. And the government enacted very, very large, very, very swift financial support, and that came through JobKeeper and JobSeeker. And it was particularly striking from a conservative government to enact hundreds of billions of dollars in support, kind of going against their ideological grain in many ways. A government that in many ways had been elected back in 2013 or so on the back of phrases like debt and deficits when talking about the other side of politics. And so for them to do that, I think, was striking and important. It put ideology aside, and it really set the Australian economy and Australia generally up for success during the pandemic. On the health front, it was more mixed. We did pretty well early on in terms of closing down the border so that we weren't importing COVID infections any more than we had already at that point. That was done relatively swiftly. And we did very well at standing up from, scratch, a contact tracing and testing regime so that we could make sure that COVID didn't spread too dramatically in the community. And we really focused on the key thing here, which is how much the virus is spreading. And what we learned during the pandemic was there's this medical term known as the effective reproduction rate, the R number. And if that's less than one, then for each person that's infected, they pass it on to less than one other person. If that's greater than one, they're passing it on to more than one other person, then the pandemic spreads exponentially and out of control. And we saw what happened in Italy and in Spain and in New York City and in other places. And we avoided that. We kept the effective reproduction rate under one, and we did very well. But then we fell down on the public health front when it came to vaccines and to testing. We infamously put all our eggs in two vaccine baskets, and we didn't buy a portfolio of vaccines. We didn't diversify our risk. We didn't buy insurance. And then we went on to make very similar mistakes when it came to rapid antigen testing. Rather than having a lot of cheap rapid antigen tests that could provide what amounted to real-time information so people could make better choices about their movements, we bet on PCR tests when countries around the world were making sure that people had antigen testing. So it was more of a mixed bag. And had we done better on vaccines and testing, then Australia would have been clearly the world's leading country in dealing with the pandemic. In the end, we did extremely well, but there was a huge missed opportunity, which cost a lot of money, a lot of lives, and a lot of angst for a lot of Australians.
So why the differences in terms of the economic and the health responses? Who was to blame here on the health side? The politicians, the bureaucrats, both?
I think ultimately politicians receive advice from officials and that they're ultimately responsible for making the decisions. On the economic front, I think Treasury gave excellent advice to the Treasurer and he not only took it, Josh Frydenberg took that advice, but was able to sell it to a sometimes sceptical cabinet, particularly as we discussed about the kind of ideological nature of hundreds of billions of dollars in support from a centre-right government. So I think it was good advice and strong leadership on the economic front. On the health front, I think the advice was really quite poor at times. I mean, we make quite a point of Scott Morrison's use of the phrase when it comes to vaccines, it's not a race, when clearly it was a race. It was a race against the virus. It was a race to get vaccinated. It was a race to be able to reopen our economy. Morrison said the wrong thing, and not to let him off the hook, he's ultimately responsible. But that precise phrase was one that he was told by Brendan Murphy. So I think on the health front.
And we just should explain here for our listeners that Brendan Murphy was the chief medical officer, who of course later became chief of the health department.
Indeed. And so I think the health minister, Greg Hunt, and the prime minister got sometimes quite poor advice on the health front, and they didn't interrogate it enough or show leadership to be able to overrule it. And I think that's the key difference between what happened on the health front and what happened on the economic front.
So what are the lessons we need to take forward from the pandemic for next time? Because there's a general belief there will be a next time at some point.
Indeed, there will be, and let's hope it's a lot later, and let's hope it's not too deadly, but we need to be prepared. I think there are broadly five things. First, I think we learned about the kind of magic of mRNA vaccines that worked so well, the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines as they were this time. We need to have domestic mRNA vaccine manufacturing capability, and there's been good progress on this with the Moderna facility being built in Victoria and is due to be completed this year. Secondly, we need to get our vaccine procurement right from the start. We need to have a diversified portfolio by all the possible vaccines because you don't know which one is going to be the best and which one is going to be first. So we need to buy insurance with vaccines. Thirdly, we need to make sure we get lots of rapid antigen tests as soon as they're available and get them right out in the community to be more practically minded about the problem of information about whether people are contagious or not. Fourth, I think our medical regulatory complex, everything from vaccine approvals to regulatory issues around testing, that failed us very, very badly. And I think we go into some detail in the book about why we need a complete overhaul of our medical regulatory complex. And finally, I think we need to keep investing in the economic infrastructure that allowed us to be so effective when it came to rolling out financial support. And we talk about a very detailed, nerdy, almost quirky thing called single touch payroll, which basically allowed the Australian Tax Office to be able to funnel the money out the door as efficiently and effectively and quickly as they did. That was infrastructure that was invested in, more than a decade prior. And we need to make sure that we keep investing in our administrative and financial infrastructure.
Can we turn now from the pandemic, the history, to the economy, the current scene and the future? The Reserve Bank this week has kept interest rates on hold. Was that the right decision?
I think it was. There was certainly no basis for an interest rate cut. We have persistent, sticky, elevated core inflation in Australia. I have argued, as several others had, that late last year or early this year, the Reserve Bank should have raised rates at least one more time to get us closer to what happened in peer jurisdictions overseas to try and beat inflation faster. The Reserve Bank's taken a different approach. They want to have interest rates peak maybe a full percentage point lower than in places like the US, and they're willing to tolerate inflation for longer. I and many others disagree with that, but they're pursuing that path. At least they're not caving into political pressure from people like Jim Chalmers and Wayne Swan to precipitously cut interest rates. And I give the governor, Michelle Bullard, great credit for standing firm on that, including in her press conference remarks yesterday.
Well, we now see the governor giving regular press conferences after each decision. Are you a fan of that new system? And is Michelle Bullock at risk of locking herself into predictions about rate movements? Because she has flagged now two or three times, more perhaps, that there won't be rate cuts for quite a long time, a very long time indeed.
I'm a fan of the press conferences. I think it's consistent with a move in international central banking to explain the thinking of the central bank more. There was a time under Alan Greenspan as Federal Reserve Chairman where central banks developed a reputation for being inscrutable. And Greenspan once said in congressional testimony, words very closely to the effect of, if you think you understand what I've said, then you're mistaken. That there was kind of, and it was even called Fed speak as a kind of inscrutability to it. Under Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen as Federal Reserve chairs and around the world, central banks have understood that it's better for them to be cautious but more open in what's underlying their thinking. The press conferences are very helpful with that. With regard to the second part of your question, I agree with you that Governor Bullock, I think, is at risk of repeating, albeit a milder version of the mistake that Philip Lowe made in providing forward guidance. Now, it's not as dramatic as saying interest rates are not going to rise until 2024, which was sort of 3 years of forward guidance or thereabouts. Governor Bullock has fallen into, I think, a little bit of a trap by saying some time ago now, over 6 weeks ago, that she and her colleagues on the board didn't think that interest rates would be cut this calendar year. That is the same sort of time-based forward guidance without reference to economic indicators, so-called state-based forward guidance, but talking about just what will happen for some period of time. I mean, I think it's a pretty good guess. I think that's what will happen, but I don't really understand what the virtue of her doing that was. I think that was probably, in hindsight, something that she may regret. I don't think it'll do any real damage because I think it's a prediction that's incredibly likely to come true.
Of course, if interest rates did fall ahead of her prediction, she would be in less trouble, I think, than Lowe was about his prediction about them not rising.
She'd certainly be more popular with the Australian public than Governor Lowe was. On the other hand, I think, you know, Wayne Swan in particular scored a bit of an own goal for his side by applying so much verbal pressure to the governor and the board with his remarks a little while ago that if rates were cut this year, it would have the tinge of bowing to political pressure, which I think would look bad and therefore makes it even less likely that rates will be cut at the November or December meeting this year.
Now, just before we started talking, we've had the latest inflation figure. This is the figure for the month of August. It's minus 0.2 for the month, giving an annual rate of inflation at 2.7%. Now, this is down from 3.5% the previous month, with the government's energy rebate feeding into this result. What's your readout of this?
Yeah, it's a story of electricity rebates and petrol prices, crude oil prices. So electricity prices August 2023 to August 2024 year have fallen by 17.9%. That's really due to the government's energy rebate. That's not about underlying inflation. That's about measured inflation. And the governor of the Reserve Bank has made it quite clear that she and her colleagues pay no attention to that kind of fiddling with the figures. So they'll just see straight through that. When it comes to automotive fuel, that fell for the year by 7.6%. That happens all the time with things like crude oil prices moving up and down in global markets. So if we look at the figure that the Reserve Bank actually focuses on, the trimmed mean, which sort of lops out the top 15% and bottom 15% of price changes, that's come in at 3.4% for the year. That is down a little from where it was a month ago at 3.8, and that's welcome. But there are two things about monthly figures. One, they're very volatile just because they're monthly, even taking out the top and bottom 15% of items. The other thing is the monthly index is still a bit of a work in progress from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. It doesn't cover all of the suite of goods that the quarterly CPI covers. So for those two reasons, I think people will focus much more on the quarterly number for their September quarter, which we'll see later this year.
Governor Bullock said the bank's board at its meeting this week discussed neither a rate rise nor a rate fall. Is a rise now completely off the table, do you think?
I don't think it's completely off the table at all. I think it'll depend a lot on these quarterly trimmed mean inflation numbers. If they keep printing with a 4 in front of them, I think that the board will have to very seriously consider a rate rise. And at the last meeting they did, the previous meeting to yesterday's, they did discuss a rate rise. So I think that's still on the table. They definitely don't want to do it. And three or so meetings ago in the press conference, Governor Bullock said, well, if you see us raise rates, you'll know that we've given up on a soft landing, or words to that effect. There's no doubt that they don't want to do it, but I think they will act if they need to. I think everyone hopes that they won't need to and hopes that inflation will come down, but I think it's a fight that's very, very far from it being over.
So when do you think rates might come down?
My view is the most likely case is very late in 2025, somewhere about 12 months from today. Again, it's going to depend on the inflation numbers, and I'd like nothing more for us to be well inside the target band and for interest rates to be able to be moderated. But my best guess, and, you know, it's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future, as the saying goes, but my best guess is about 12 to 15 months from where we are now.
That's pretty depressing news for home buyers, let alone for the government at a political level.
I think both of those things are true. I think it's a real shame that we took a different strategy in Australia to what peer jurisdictions overseas did, which was raise rates more aggressively, take our medicine, have tamed inflation, and now be cutting rates. That's the story in the US and several other jurisdictions. We've taken a different path. And, you know, most importantly, Australian households, through persistent inflation, are paying the price for that. And I think the government is paying a political price for it as well.
The government, especially the Treasurer Jim Chalmers, wants to reform the Reserve Bank to split the bank's board into two, one of which would be a specialist monetary policy board to deal with interest rates. Now, this has been stymied by the opposition, but is this proposed reform important, and what difference do you think it would make?
I think it's a good reform. I've been supportive of it. And I think the review panel into the RBA did a very nice job in their suite of recommendations, particularly this one. It has been stymied. I think that's a shame. The idea is to get more technical expertise onto the board in terms of the things that go into setting interest rates. That's not to say that the existing board aren't very distinguished and accomplished Australians, but they tend to have less expertise in the factors that go into setting interest rates than peer boards do in other jurisdictions overseas. So I think it would be a good change. That said, I do understand where the opposition are coming from in terms of saying, well, if you sort of look at the composition of things in the next term of government, if Labor stays in government, they would be able to appoint all six of the external members of that Monetary Policy Board. And I can understand why someone like Angus Taylor is concerned about that. I think the government had an opportunity to provide some assurances about that by saying who the initial appointments would be. I don't have visibility into who they might have proposed, but they had a chance to cut a deal, and that hasn't happened. I think that's a shame. And obviously the Greens are asking for extreme and unpalatable things in order for them to approve this reform. So I think it's kind of dead and buried now. We just need to move on. And I think the one thing that really points to is saying that in future appointments to the existing board structure, there's nothing stopping there being more specialist monetary policy expertise in the appointments to those boards. And indeed, historically, there have been people like Warwick McKibben and Bob Gregory and others who've been very distinguished economists with that kind of expertise have sat on the board. There's nothing stopping there be one, two, three or more of those folks being appointed. So that's something that's really in Jim Chalmers' hands.
I think Chalmers did try and provide some guarantees by saying that existing board members who wanted to transfer to the Monetary Board could do so, but they didn't seem guarantees that went far enough for the opposition when those negotiations were on. I just wonder, would you like to be a candidate for the Monetary Policy Board if it got going?
Well, that's a very flattering suggestion, Michelle. That's obviously not up to me, and I'd be surprised if I was high on the Treasurer's list, given some of my commentary, including in this podcast. But look, I think it's important to get more expertise, and I think there's some outstanding candidates around the country, and I'd like to see that in whatever board structure. I'd like to see more of that expertise. And as I say, there's lots of good candidates.
Now, just finally, today the idea of cutting back on negative gearing has been once again floated. There's a report that Treasury is doing some work on this. It's unclear whether this is actually a serious proposition in the marketplace, in the ideas marketplace. The government has left the way open but hasn't taken it further than that. What is your view on that? Would this be helpful in getting us more housing properties? And what would be the tax implications?
I think it would be helpful. Way back in 2015, I wrote a report for the Mikkel Institute advocating a gradual phase out through sort of grandfathering of negative gearing. And the guts of that proposal became Labor's policy at the 2016 and 2019 elections vis-a-vis negative gearing. I still think that the three reasons that I proposed in that report for why that would be a good idea to phase out negative gearing are sound. They were that there's a financial budgetary cost to doing it. Secondly, there's issues around financial stability when people particularly have multiple highly leveraged investment properties. There's a real chance in a property market downturn of there being big fire sales that can create a lot of financial collateral damage across the economy. And thirdly, getting rid of negative gearing would put potential owner-occupiers on a level playing field with investors at an auction. So I think it'd be very good news for people trying to move from the rental market into being owner-occupiers. So I think it'd be good news for the classic Australian dream. I mean, to be fair about it, the existence of negative gearing is something that puts downward pressure on rents. So negative gearing in a funny way is good for renters who are always going to rent, but bad for renters who want to buy. So there are pros and cons. And of course, then, as you pointed out, then there's the politics of the whole thing. But I think it was a good idea 8 or 9 years ago. I think it's still a good idea today. And I think it's interesting that the government seemed to be at least floating the test balloon. The one piece of unsolicited free advice that I will give them is certainly don't tag on some additional and questionable policy about franking credits as they did at the 2019 election. But I'm sure Chris Bowen and Bill Shorten will remind their colleagues of the consequences of doing that.
I think they've learnt the lesson on that one, and we'll see whether that balloon floats or is pricked in coming days. Richard Holden, thank you very much for talking with the podcast today. That's all for this time. Thank you to my producer, Ben Roper. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.